Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, they'll stone you when you're trying to be so good. They'll stone you just like they said they would. They'll stone you when you're trying to go home. They'll stone you when you're there all alone. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned. Well, today, for the second time, we're going to pot. Yep, last year we talked about the emerging issue, or was then emerging, of medical marijuana. We spoke to a fascinating fellow named Steve D'Angelo, who was the subject of a Discovery Channel TV show called Weed Wars, and it was all about his medical marijuana dispensary in California. And I thought that was pretty cutting edge, but you know, sometimes events just overtake us. And so now we're not talking about medical marijuana. We're talking about recreational marijuana. Let me repeat, pot for fun. Two states in our union thus far have decriminalized the recreational use of marijuana and are now trying to figure out exactly how that works under our federal system. Because you see, as eager as they are to decriminalize marijuana, the federal government, the national government, still considers marijuana a very serious drug. In fact, it puts it on its highest alert level. It's Schedule 1 under the Controlled Substances Act. And this creates a problem. It creates a problem in what we call federalism, the relationship of the state governments on the one side to the federal government on the other. It creates specifically an issue with something we call the Supremacy Clause of Article 6. What's a poor American to do if he happens to live in one of these states? Well, fortunately, we have Rob Mikos to explain it all to us. Now, Rob Mikos is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, a fine institution right here in the state of Tennessee. He specializes in federalism and criminal law. In fact, his most recent article is called A Critical Appraisal of the Department of Justice's New Approach to Medical Marijuana. So who better to explain the constitutional landscape to us? Rob Mikos of Vanderbilt University.
Thank you for having me, Stuart.
Absolutely. Now tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what you do.
I am currently a law professor at Vanderbilt University and director of their program in law and government. And I've spent the last 10 years or so in the legal academy studying federalism, and really the last 5 or 6 years with a focus on the balance of power over this very contentious issue regarding drug law reform, and the most important iteration of that being medical marijuana reforms and more recently the marijuana legalization reforms going on in a couple of states.
Well, I must say, Rob, that you backed the right horse. You picked one of the hottest emerging topics one can imagine.
I happened into this one. I was at the University of California, Davis, when I started writing about this issue, and obviously this was a hot topic in California, but it's grown more important than I think anyone could have imagined at the time.
Absolutely. I knew there had to be a California connection in here somewhere. Okay. Well, why don't you explain to us from the very beginning, first of all, you used this term federalism. What does federalism mean, and how is it implicated in this legalization of marijuana debate?
In a nutshell, federalism refers to the relationship between the state governments and the national government. What powers do they share? What powers are exclusive to the state governments, exclusive to the federal government? What authority does the federal government have to dictate the content of state law and the assistance of state law enforcement? So federalism, in a nutshell, is just about that relationship between the state and federal governments.
That whole states' rights thing that we're always talking about here.
Correct. And this is implicated across a broad range of issues today and historically, everything from race relations and civil rights to health care, obviously with the Affordable Care Act litigation that's ongoing, and drug law reforms as well.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Why do these reforms of drug laws in the various states, how do they bring up federalism?
Well, because there's such a stark contrast between the content of state and federal policy. The federal government has taken a no-prisoners approach to this issue. It has banned the drug marijuana outright, making, practically speaking, no exception for the legal use or cultivation of the drug. Recently, just about 17 years ago, starting in California, you had some states that started to take a different approach. Historically, at least since the 1930s, all of the states had taken a similar approach to the federal government. They had banned marijuana outright. But in the mid-1990s, starting with California, you had a few states that started to recognize that this drug might have some medicinal benefits. And so they started to legalize it, at least in this narrow context. They were saying, if you use this pursuant to the recommendation of a physician, if you suffered from a list of medical conditions approved by the state, you could go ahead and use this drug legally under state law without running afoul of federal law or being penalized under state law. So there's a stark contrast between that state approach, which allows marijuana for some purposes, and the federal approach, which says marijuana is never legal outside of very, very narrow research contexts.
Well, what's confusing about this for a lot of people, and thank you for that explanation because that's very helpful, but what's confusing for a lot of people, especially people who've heard of the Supremacy Clause, is the idea that, you've got a conflict between the feds on the one side and the states on the other. So doesn't that mean, first of all, is there a conflict? Does this create an actual conflict between state and federal law?
Well, it's harder to imagine a starker conflict than this. A state allowing something that the federal government expressly forbids.
So
you have a conflict here, but it's important to note that there's a limit to federal supremacy. And so there's a little bit more nuance to this conflict than that. So on the one hand, a state is allowed under constitutional law to legalize something the federal government forbids. If a state simply says, we don't want to regulate this particular subject, we don't want to have any law governing marijuana, that's something a state can do under a doctrine called the anti-commandeering rule. Now, a state can't go any further. A state couldn't block the application of federal law. That's what we typically mean by the supremacy of federal law.
Yeah, actually, that was what I was heading for, Rob, is that if California, for example, simply says, we're just not going to have any law regarding marijuana, which is effectively what legalization is, at least in many iterations, they can do that. They simply say, there's no conflict. We're just not going to regulate it. That leaves the federal law in place. And, oh, by the way, we're not going to enforce it, the federal law either, says the state. So in a sense, there really isn't a conflict because California is simply saying hands off.
That's correct. In a legal sense, you could say that this isn't a relevant conflict for purposes of constitutional law. I think on a more practical level, everyone would say, there's a clear conflict here. You're saying you're not going to do anything about a drug that the federal government says is absolutely forbidden. So I think it's a little bit tougher to explain than that. It's not simply saying, well, this isn't a conflict. I think it's saying recognizing that there's a tension here. Maybe conflict isn't the right word, but there's a tension here, and why states are allowed to create this sort of tension, and just how far they can push their laws. So constitutionally speaking, a state is allowed just to throw up its hands and say, we're not going to do anything about this. That puts the ball back in the federal government's court, on its side of the court. The federal government can go ahead in all of the 18 states that have medical marijuana laws, the two states that recently passed legalization of recreational marijuana. federal government can go ahead and prosecute anyone there that it wants. You can't raise state law as a defense. But here's where the real limit to supremacy comes into play, and that's that the federal government has a very difficult time of enforcing its ban entirely on its own. So you can talk about formal law, and you can talk about the formal supremacy of federal law and the national ban on marijuana, but on a ground level, as a practical matter, I think people pay a lot more attention to the content of state law because the states have a much greater enforcement capacity. People care and are much more likely to be caught and punished by a state than they are by the federal government.
Yeah, most of us have had some kind of encounter, and we hope it was a pleasant one, with state law enforcement officials. Most of us probably go through life, and we never really have an encounter with an FBI agent or an ATF agent or somebody else from the federal government. So you're right. So maybe it's just a matter, as a practical matter, it's the old adage, if the feds want to enforce this law, they've got to put their money where their mouth is.
That's exactly right. It's now entirely on their shoulders. For decades, the federal ban has really only been around for about four decades now, but for that entire span, the federal government has relied extensively on state law enforcement officials helping to enforce the bans on marijuana. And states have willingly done this up until recently. In fact, there are more than a million arrests every year for various marijuana offenses. The vast majority of those are initiated by state law enforcement officials. So if a state starts to say, we're going to rethink this, we're going to stop making these arrests, it's going to have a pretty dramatic impact on the ground, on the perceived sanction and the likelihood of getting caught for using or growing or selling marijuana.
Right, unless, of course, the feds put their money where their mouth is. But constitutionally speaking, if I'm following you correctly, then probably the simplest, easiest thing for a state to do would simply be to erase any reference to marijuana in its statute books and simply stop enforcing any sort of prohibition on marijuana, step back, and let the feds do whatever the feds are going to do. The problems, it seems to me, though, really start to arise when a state tries to do something less than that, when they try to authorize only certain types of marijuana, maybe medical marijuana, and when they actually go out and start regulating it, then arguably they're doing something, actively doing something, that really does conflict directly with federal law, and apparently the feds have actually started threatening state governments on that basis, haven't they?
You've put your finger exactly on the right issue here. No state wants to eliminate all regulations, all restrictions on marijuana. At the very least, everyone supports banning the possession and sale of marijuana to minors, mm-hmm. for example. And the states that have pursued medical marijuana laws and broader legalization measures, they want to keep a tight control on the industry. They want it to be sold, this drug to be sold by licensed purveyors. They want to treat it similarly to alcohol. And as we know, alcohol is a fairly tightly controlled substance. But you're right. Now, state power really is at the mercy of the federal government. The Constitution doesn't give states the right to regulate a drug like this, only gives them the constitutional power to not regulate it, to back off. At the same time, though, I want to point out that the federal government doesn't want to go this entirely alone. I think it realizes that it's not up to the task. It just doesn't have the resources to rein in marijuana. And when Congress passed its ban, this was part of the Controlled Substances Act back in the 1970s, it put in language about what the states could and could not do. This is an express preemption provision is what lawyers call it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest that that provision says, for one thing, that the federal government didn't want to occupy the entire field. In other words, it didn't want to kick states out of the business of regulating drugs altogether. Instead, it only wanted to block the operation of those laws that positively conflict with federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the most natural interpretation of that is one that says a state can't assist someone in violating federal law. And let me give you a couple examples of how a state might do that. These are fairly far-fetched. A couple of states have proposed this, but none has really gotten past the gatepost.
Mm-hmm.
So one possibility would be you have a state that actually grows and sells the drug directly. It would be similar to a state-owned alcohol store.
Yeah.
That would be the state directly violating federal law, clearly preempted by the Controlled Substances Act, and you would also have state employees potentially subject to federal criminal prosecution.
Well, you say that sounds far-fetched, but it really isn't. I mean, a state might very well decide that's the easiest, the best way to regulate it, just like having an ABC store. And moreover, it's a great way to make a little bit of state revenue, actually quite a bit of state revenue.
Oh, it is. I think it would be a very effective regulatory technique, but I think, and it's been proposed in a number of different states as a way to tightly control this drug in a way you can't once you let private vendors handle it. But I think folks have realized the legal ramifications and the difficulty, the legal problems that arise when the state is actively involved in this. So constitutionally speaking and legally speaking, there's a difference between a state letting someone else, a private vendor, violate federal law and a state actually involving itself in that violation.
Yeah, the big difference is called risk.
it is risk and uncertainty. And you can make the case, I think you can make a plausible case that other state regulations are not preempted, that they don't actually involve the state in committing a violation of federal law, but there's some risk involved. You know, there's not a lot of certainty here, and very few courts have touched these issues. So I would contrast state provision, a state marijuana store with a state licensing system. And mm-hmm. this is something where you have seen some federal officials, United States attorneys, claiming, a state official who gives a license to a private vendor to go out and sell marijuana pursuant to state law is actually violating federal law. And I think that's wrong. I think when a state merely licenses someone to go out and sell this drug that's forbidden under federal law, merely licenses it, all they're doing in that instance is saying, we're not going to punish you. The state itself is not going to punish you. And so I think a state is allowed to engage in some regulations like this. And I think that is something that Congress would welcome. I think the Congress would like the states to do something to rein in marijuana. They may prefer that the states ban it and throw people in jail for selling it, but I think they would rather have the states impose some limitations, like a licensing regime, rather than having the states do nothing at all, which is really the alternative that you have under different arguments concerning preemption.
Yeah, that may be true, and maybe Congress will eventually come to that conclusion. But, of course, in the short term, if I'm a state official and I'm involved in some sort of regulatory scheme involving marijuana, medical or recreational, there's a level of risk because, my local U.S. attorney could get, a burr under her saddle and say, mm-hmm. we're coming after you. And there's an argument that anything the state does to facilitate someone in breaking federal marijuana laws is, in some sense, acting as an accessory. In fact, I've heard that other entities, such as banks, private entities, have been warned off by the federal government. It's extremely difficult for a medical marijuana dispensary, for example, in California or elsewhere, to even have a bank account because the feds have said, you're now facilitating, money laundering for drug money. So anyone who even helps in any way, whether you're a state official or a private person, is possibly going to be charged with aiding and abetting somebody who's violating a federal statute.
Well, I agree with you that there's a risk out there. I think with respect to state officials, they're not helping anyone in any relevant way.
Mm-hmm.
If a state official simply says, you have lots of situations now where you have a state police officer who pulls someone over, discovers that they have marijuana in their possession, and the state police officer lets them go. And we wouldn't say in that instance that the state police officer is committing a violation of federal law by not punishing that mm-hmm. individual. And I think a licensing regime is nothing more than that. A licensing regime is just a state saying, we are not going to punish you if you engage in this behavior. We're not going to help you, but we're not going to punish you for doing that.
What about taxing it, though? And now, what if you actually tax the proceeds from the sale of marijuana if you're the state of California and you tax it? What about that? Isn't that enough to run afoul of federal law?
Well, the interesting thing there is that a tax is just another form of sanction.
Mm-hmm.
So the tax doesn't help anyone grow marijuana or sell it. In fact, it's a burden on those people who are growing and selling the drug. It adds a cost to their business. It's not jail, but you could say it's in line with other forms of sanctions. And in fact, the oddity here is that taxes on illicit drugs are not that uncommon. That there are actually, I think, more than a dozen states, nearly 20 states now, that have taxes on illegal marijuana. In other words, they tax marijuana even though it is a crime to sell it under state law. And these are not necessarily the same states that have medical marijuana laws or legal recreational marijuana. And no one has claimed to this date that a tax is preempted by federal law. In fact, the federal government, if anything, has encouraged throwing as many different restrictions on the marijuana industry as you can imagine.
I hadn't really thought of it that way, but you're right. A lot of states will tax illegal activity, which leads to the sort of anomalous circumstance where sometimes criminals will actually file returns to avoid tax consequences, but I digress. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we often digress around here, but only when it's interesting. Today we're speaking with Robert Mikos, a professor at Vanderbilt Law School, who's telling us all about the tensions created when the states start legalizing recreational marijuana and the federal government doesn't. Stick around.
Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it. Some call it time.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're about to continue our discussion with Professor Robert Mikos of Vanderbilt Law School. We're talking all about recreational marijuana and what happens when states legalize it and the feds don't. And some of the implications of this are kind of strange. Things like, taxes. This is just a fascinating area. What do you see happening over the next few years as these initiatives apparently seem to be gaining momentum in a variety of states?
Well, they do. I think eventually the federal government is going to have to find a clear and coherent strategy for dealing with these state initiatives. As it's happened, we have seen some statements coming from the Department of Justice, but they've been very cautious statements. In 2009, for example, there was something issued called the Ogden Memorandum, where an official in the DOJ tried to set forth the department's policy for when they would actually prosecute medical marijuana cases. But it was hedged in a number of important regards, didn't give terribly clear guidance, was sort of dependent on different formulations of state law. And, some folks took this as a blessing from the federal government to go ahead and grow and sell the drug as long as they complied with federal law. And then they learned to the contrary just months later that the federal government would actually crack down on them, that the federal government has continued to sort of try to scare away landlords from renting to medical marijuana dispensaries and so on. So I think what we'll need over the next couple of years is a more clear and cohesive strategy from the federal government, one that binds not just the DOJ and the DOJ is a somewhat fragmented agency. You've got U.S. attorneys in different districts and different states taking different approaches to medical marijuana and towards these recreational marijuana initiatives. You're going to need something from the top down that really sets forth a clear and cohesive federal strategy. And you're also going to need something that really binds not just the DOJ, but other agencies that have a say and have an impact on medical marijuana. Just to give you a couple examples, the Veterans Administration runs hospitals for veterans, some of whom want to take advantage of these state laws and use marijuana pursuant to state law to treat a condition like PTSD. And in the past, the Veterans Department has taken the position that this is contrary to federal law, and if you are found using marijuana, you no longer qualify for drug benefits under the Veterans Administration. So in a sense, it's not just getting the DOJ to issue a clear and coherent strategy, whatever that might be, but it's also bringing in line all of these other federal agencies as well that have a say over this particular issue. And that's going to be enormously tricky.
Well, you've mentioned... You've mentioned Congress, Rob, but that, you know, I think a statutory solution, of course, would be a marvelous thing if Congress were able to agree on anything. But it also, it seems, that this is eminently something that would be appropriate for a grand sweeping executive order. I mean, President Obama could sign an order essentially telling all the executive agencies to get on the same page with regard to marijuana, and he could order the Veterans Administration as well as the DOJ, as well as the ATF and the FBI and all of them to simply do whatever he thinks is best with regard to this. Is that what you're advocating, an executive order?
Well, it could be an executive order. I think as a practical matter, it would be unrealistic to expect Congress to do anything, at least anything that's going to be sort of meaningful in this regard. So the president could issue an executive order. I mean, there would be some controversy if the president simply said, we have a ban on marijuana. We have a number of statutes, including tax codes that say that you're subject to various tax penalties if you sell the drug. You have gun laws that say you can't possess a firearm if you use this drug. It would be tough for the president to stand up and say, let's just ignore all these provisions of law. But there is the possibility of the president doing that. The president simply saying, we've all got to get on the same page. I don't agree with the content of the current law. It, you know, diminishes the power of the states. Let's pull back a little bit here, and you know, here's what we're going to do. We're going to permit this to occur as long as the state gives its blessing. That would be a possibility. That's a much more, you know, as a pragmatic matter, it's a much more realistic alternative, but it's also one that we're a little bit, we might find a little bit unseemly, because it does require the president to basically ignore some very explicit congressional statutes governing marijuana.
Yeah, that's always tough. On the other hand, at least with regard to the criminal statutes, there's that concept of prosecutorial discretion. I mean, and the president, to the U.S. attorneys all the way down the line to the FBI agents in the field, you know, they've got lots and lots of criminal laws to enforce, and they can choose which ones they're going to give the highest priority to. And so in its simplest terms, the president could basically say, make it your lowest priority.
That's absolutely right, and some state and local governments have done the same sort of thing. They've actually used a provision called a make marijuana your lowest priority to try to discourage law enforcement from bringing these prosecutions.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say that this is consistent with the president's duty to enforce the laws, because you know, the Constitution doesn't demand the impossible. If Congress doesn't give the president a multifold increase in the law enforcement budget, the president can't possibly prosecute every single marijuana case out there. There are just too many of them. And so it's up to the president to decide, you know, how do I prioritize this very scarce and low law enforcement budget? And this would be one valid way of doing that.
Yeah. Let's cross a little bit over from the constitutional to the political, and the two concepts often intersect. What accounts for the fact that the Obama administration has not done something along those lines? Because my understanding was his perspective, is that he didn't think marijuana should be something that was a high priority, and he hasn't actually come out in favor, I think, of legalizing it. But why hasn't he done this? Why are some of his U.S. attorneys being allowed to be as aggressive as they have been?
Well, I think part of it is a concern over the content of state law. So you actually have a lot of variation from one state to the next. We can talk about legalization in the abstract. You can talk about the legalization of medical marijuana in the abstract. But when you get into the details and you investigate the laws of some states, like California, I think you might discover that these laws are easily abused. So you might support sort of in the abstract, the notion that sick individuals ought to be allowed to try out this treatment. But that, I think, in the opinion of many, is not really what's going on in California, that the state doesn't really hasn't done a good job of regulating the drug. So in a sense, I think the variation in response is somewhat triggered by the inability or the failure of some states to do a good job of actually reining in this particular industry and keeping a tight lid on it. So that might explain why Obama has been somewhat reticent to embrace these state reforms. I think also it wasn't an important political issue over the last few years. So it didn't get the attention maybe that a lot of folks think it deserves. That could very well change in a second-term presidency, especially towards the last couple of years. You may see the president actually taking a formal action. It could be an executive order simply instructing United States attorneys not to bring these sort of prosecutions. It could even be another possibility that the president is expressly allowed to take is to reschedule marijuana, which would allow for it to be prescribed by a physician. It would allow for it to be provided by, well-regulated pharmaceutical industry.
Would that require a statutory fix, or is the placement of a drug on a particular schedule or a particular list, is that something that's left within the discretion of the president and his bureaucracy?
That's left to the executive branch.
Oh, okay. So then that really would be, he could do that.
Right. In theory, the president could move it from Schedule 1, which is a type of drug like heroin that is never allowed, mm-hmm. to Schedule 2, where it would be allowed in some limited circumstances under tightly controlled conditions. Even further down the list to Schedule 3, the president could say, I want to take this off the scheduling altogether. So there's no regulations or no ban on the particular drug. That would be, I think it would be a fairly modest shift to move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a boon in the medical marijuana states, but in states like Colorado and Washington that want to legalize it for recreational purposes as well, that recreational use would still be prohibited by federal law. But the president does have some power here to actually change the content of the law. That's something that the president could try to do. It's just something that the bureaucracy has resisted for the past 20 years.
Yeah, it's always a myth that presidents can just say, do this, do that, and things instantly happen. Every president has to deal with a large bureaucracy, and those bureaucracies have a way of gaining their own momentum, don't they?
Yes, they do. And I've heard stories told of even of moves in the other direction, trying to reschedule a drug and make it harder to obtain that drug. Even those moves can be resisted and take a lot of political support. So there's a lot of inertia when it comes to controlled substances law. So rescheduling marijuana, it's theoretically possible. It's something the president could do without an act of Congress, but it's, as a practical matter, again, it has its own set of hurdles to pass.
Well, that may simply be the explanation for all of this confusion. May simply be that the president and his advisors have not been willing to invest the political capital in this issue. There's that whole they've got lots of other other conflicting priorities out there. They've got that whole fiscal cliff thing. They've got the environment. They've got immigration, and maybe they simply don't want to alienate anybody or use any political capital to deal with this problem.
I think that's right. I think that's why it didn't come up in the election.
Mm-hmm.
The president tried to avoid it as much as possible. In addition to the issues you mentioned, you've got gun control.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another one where the president's going to have to spend political capital. You've got the issue of same-sex marriage, all sorts of issues that are really hot-button issues that I think are going to capture most of the president's attention in the next couple of years.
It'll be interesting to see what happens, but I guess if we can conclude one thing from this fairly clearly, it's that states' rights is not the exclusive province of conservatives.
That's correct. So this isn't the only example, but clearly this is an issue where you've got the libertarian side of the issue, of course, but also the liberal side that supports a more permissive drug control policy clearly has a reason to embrace federalism here and states' rights. There's little headway to be made with the federal government and little headway that has been made over the last four decades, but there have been some astonishing victories
by libertarian liberals.
Yeah.
There have been some astonishing
monumental
victories.
Reforms at the state level.
Yes. I guess I keep waiting for California to announce it's going to secede. And then they can have whatever drug laws they want.
That would be true.
Well, Rob Mikos of Vanderbilt University Law School, thank you so much for talking with us about this very interesting issue of federalism and drug laws and marijuana laws in particular.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Professor Rob Mikos from Vanderbilt University, who's sort of given us the constitutional landscape for all of this legalization of recreational marijuana that's been going on in our country of late. Next, after the break, we're going to go down into the trenches. We're going to go down and see what's happening from the perspective of a fascinating fellow by the name of Howard Wooldridge. I won't tell you too much about Howard yet. I'll simply say he's a big old cop. He's got a big old cowboy hat. Stick around.
Thomas Jefferson, in a rare disagreement with James Madison, let it be known that he believed the absence of a Bill of Rights was a dangerous omission in the new Constitution. Jefferson wrote that he was thoroughly unconvinced by the arguments from James Wilson that a Bill of Rights was unnecessary in a government whose powers were already limited through enumeration. The doctrine of limited powers, he said, was opposed by strong inferences from the body of the instrument. Moreover, the Article of Confederation had declared in express terms that each state would retain every power not expressly delegated to Congress. The new Constitution did not. Jefferson concluded that a Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against every government on earth, general or particular, and what no just government should refuse or rest on inferences. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject today is pot, Mary Jane, marijuana, and specifically the recreational variety, which is now legal in two states. Now, we've previously been speaking with Professor Rob Mikos of Vanderbilt University, who gave us the basic constitutional landscape, but now it's time to get down in the trenches with a fellow I've had on the show several times, fascinating character. His name is Howard Wooldridge, and Howard heads up an organization called COP, which stands for Citizens Opposing Prohibition. Specifically, he's talking about the sort of citizen that he himself is. He's a guy who spent years and years in law enforcement and who's come to the conclusion that the prohibition of drugs, and specifically the prohibition of marijuana, is counterproductive in a number of ways. And so he's been fighting for a number of years to decriminalize drugs generally, but most specifically marijuana. And it's just been a remarkable turnabout in the last year or so since we first started having him on the show. So I thought I'd bring Howard Wooldridge in for a drug war update.
Good to be with you again, Stuart.
It must be you have had an absolutely remarkable year. What in the world is going on with you folks?
Well, here in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C., there is a palpable feeling of optimism on the part of drug reform in that with the victories of legalization of marijuana in Washington State and Colorado by a robust 55% and 56%, that changes in the air. Even Republicans are starting to say 10th Amendment, states' rights, may be the right way to go when it comes to drug policy. So I'm in the Capitol 3 days a week talking to staff and once in a while a member, and I feel it also. The resistance to my message on Capitol Hill is approaching a mathematical zero.
It was just, what, a year or so ago, maybe 18 months ago, that you came out to Grundy, Virginia, and we spoke about prohibition, and we had our forum, and we talked about medical marijuana as well. And what has happened in the last year and a half?
Well, there's been growing realization across a broad spectrum of Americans. Since I was down in your neck of the woods, for example, the NAACP came out at their national convention and said the war on drugs is bad policy, it's got to go. That's just one example amongst many where mainstream organizations are analyzing this, looking at it and saying there are no advantages, there are no benefits for my constituency, and so therefore we need to condemn this thing because of the horrific costs to each group. And as I say to in general, from my experience as a street cop, the war on drugs, drug prohibition, has been the most destructive, dysfunctional, and immoral policy since slavery and Jim Crow. And more people, in fact, a majority of people today, I believe, understand that and are ready for a change.
Could you expand on that aspect a bit? I don't think some people might not realize what you mean when you say it's the worst thing since Jim Crow.
Well, Michelle Alexander came out with a great book called The War on Drugs is the New Jim Crow. Worse to that effect. And she put down in chapter and verse how people of color are horribly impacted by this much more than the Caucasians of this country. And I saw this live and in color. There was a gentleman would be nice. Yeah. An officer I worked with. He said it to me quite openly at the donut shop. He said, "Howard, two blacks, two browns, two yellows, or I don't stop the car. Why bother?" And of course, he used racial epithets there. But the point is, he was a racist officer who essentially protected white people from arrest and went after people of color. And that's very common across my profession. I would say a sizable minority of police officers across the country have that same attitude, and that's why your arrest records and rates for black to white, say for marijuana, is like 7-1. For Hispanics, it's 4-1.
And so I guess what you're saying is that the prohibition, certainly of small amounts of marijuana and other common street drugs, what, they simply give an excuse to ill-intentioned police officers to target minorities?
Sure. You know, we are, in my opinion, my experience, we are no more prejudiced or bad, if you will, than any other profession. The difference is we have a badge and a gun and handcuffs, and we act out against people we don't like. And therefore, this sizable minority just simply goes after people of color, and command tolerates it and or encourages it, because with drug prohibition and due to what's called civil asset forfeiture, we actually make money or potentially make money with every drug arrest. Well, we can take the money in your pocket, we can take your car if you have enough felony amounts, etc. So we have a financial interest, especially in these hard times, economic times, and the likelihood that a poor person / person of color would fight this legalized theft on the street is minimal. So that's why they make easy targets and easy victims.
Yeah, it reminds me of an episode we did a few months ago with Ira Glasser, the former, I think, executive director of the ACLU, and we were talking about stop and frisk.
New York City, horrific.
New York City primarily, but then also other cities around the country have adopted it, and that seemed to, it ties into that, because as he said, if you stop and frisk people, and they've got a small amount of marijuana in there, it's very easy to justify the arrest, you know, after the fact.
Yeah, and that also points up the destruction of the Fourth Amendment. When I went through the police academy, you can stop and frisk people if you meet the criteria of what's called Terry versus Ohio, called a Terry stop. The trouble is that was for weapons, not for patting someone down, feeling something in their pocket that was obviously not a weapon. Perhaps it was a little bit of marijuana. They pull it out and then arrest for it. My best information, you tell me differently, that's actually a violation of the Fourth Amendment. There is no justification to stop and frisk someone for non-threatening items like marijuana in your pocket.
Well, that issue is making its way through the courts now, and I think the judges pretty much agree with you, Howard. I think that policy is going to be curtailed or stopped completely before very long. So that's one reason. I mean, you've got civil rights groups, and you've got groups that are concerned about those issues and how its effect on minorities, and especially young minority men. What are the other reasons? What for the sea change in attitudes toward marijuana?
Well, certainly the economic crisis has meant that across the country, somewhere, I just read a stat, about 16%, 16% of police officers have been lost in these last 4 years. And that means the thin blue line is thinner, and the number of laws we have has actually, of course, increased. The politicians always like to make it against the law to do something. So police departments and sheriff's departments are stretched thin, and in my mind, they have to make hard choices as to who to go after. And unfortunately, because of the lucrative nature of drug enforcement, they're letting other things go. There was a report in the New York Times the other day, and I've seen this also in federal testimony here in the House of Representatives. Somewhere in the area of 400,000, Stuart, 400,000 rape kits, officially known as sexual assault kits, have not been opened and processed to find out the DNA and go find the bad guy and arrest him. 400,000 rape victims have been not taken care of properly by the the criminal justice community for whatever reasons, that they continue, of course, to fully fund their drug squads. And so women who've been raped, children who've been raped, their bad guys have not been caught. And one of the reasons is because we focus so much on the nonviolent, Willie Nelson, Snoop Lion, Charlie Sheen, or Rush Limbaugh. This drives me crazy.
Well, you want to take any credit here among all these reasons? I mean, you've been lobbying tirelessly. Mm-hmm. I get periodic updates. I subscribe to your newsletter and mm-hmm. just to see what's going on there. And you seem tireless. You're always on Capitol Hill making presentations. Do you think maybe it's just a matter of you and other people on your side of the issue being persuasive and bringing good arguments to bear?
Sure. My organizations that I represent, we go to Rotaries and Kiwanis Clubs. We go to other public forums. And give people the best information so that they can make a rational decision on the issue of drug use, drug abuse. And on Capitol Hill, there's about four of us that work full-time, four organizations that have a full-time representative in the United States Congress, making those presentations and continuing to stress the importance of making drug issues a matter for the medical community, not the criminal justice community. That's the macro is, if you got a drug problem, see a doctor. The police and the prisons should be places where we take care of people you are afraid of. And personally, I'm not afraid of a Charlie Sheen nor a Rush Limbaugh. I'm afraid of people that might hurt myself, my wife, or my grandkids.
I don't know. I think Charlie Sheen is a little scary from time to time.
Okay, I might give you Charlie.
All right. Now, you mentioned a moment ago, it's Washington State and Colorado have both legalized or decriminalized, perhaps is the better term, recreational marijuana. This is not even the medical sort of marijuana. What's going on in those states? How are they implementing those laws?
Yes, and it is truly, this is now just legalization, no decrim. Legalization, regulation, taxation of the green plant for personal use, and in both states there are commissions which are, as we speak, gathering testimony and information on how best to produce and sell this this marijuana, which has been illegal now for at least 80 years at the federal level and state level, and both are headed both. Commissions I have confidence in will come up with rational rules and regulations, not too much taxation, which would, of course, promote and encourage the continuance of the black market. I know a couple people on the board in Washington State, in Olympia, and also in Denver. And these are people who I have confidence in will come up with a very good regulatory scheme, which will make everybody happy, except, of course, for those people who believe in prohibition.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point you make about the level of taxation. Of course, that's a policy issue in both states, and I'm sure both states are very eager to get their hands on as much tax revenue as possible, but that's why we still have moonshiners. And, of course, the constitutional issue is, of course, that tension between the state government on the one side and the federal government, and the federal government, as you know, of course, still prohibits marijuana as a Schedule I plant. What's the attitude? Are you getting any sense of the attitude of the local U.S. attorneys or the Justice Department people out in those states?
Well, Stuart, there has been an absolute, what I call, thundering silence from the Justice Department, Mr. Holder and company. There is not a hint of a whisper in the halls of anywhere in Washington, D.C. As you've noted, I keep a pretty good ear to the ground. I've got friends and colleagues who actually from time to time make it to the White House and such, and they've told me there is zero indication of which way the Justice Department is going to go, on whether they will crack down on these storefronts that would sell personal use marijuana, or is this going to be a national policy, or pretty much like it is today, it is up to the local assistant attorney general to make his or her own decision on where to put the resources, which would include perhaps not going after the marijuana. As in, you know, with 18 states with medical marijuana, have you ever heard of the feds going after someplace in Maine, for example, or Vermont? These are states that New Mexico. These are states that have medical marijuana, and yet the federal government is basically silent. So it has been left up to the local assistant attorney generals. And I've got a feeling, if I have to bet a dollar, I believe the Obama administration is going to do the same thing with the personal use dispensaries, where it'll be up to the local AG where he or she wants to put the resources.
Yeah, well, as you know, though, that leaves certainly a lot of room for a local U.S. attorney, for example, in California, to crack down pretty heavily. And apparently that there are a couple of U.S. attorneys out there who have done that.
Oh, yeah. Under Obama, more medical marijuana dispensaries were shut down and raided than under Bush. So it's kind of bizarro.
And you don't think they're going to come out with any one policy and send that out over the wire to all of their U.S. attorneys?
That is my sense. I say, if I have to bet, $5, because they've had now 3 full months since the election. Plus, before that, they knew that the polls were showing it was going to go our way. So they've had plenty of time to decide what to do. And this thundering silence, I believe, is going to continue until the first storefronts are open and beyond.
Well, that's really interesting you should say that, because I've spoken to some federal law enforcement officials in the past couple of months, and that's exactly the response I've gotten. They all kind of smile at me and change the subject.
Well, they're politicians trying to keep their GS-14 rating.
I guess that must be it. I think there's some news also from Capitol Hill, isn't there?
Yeah, it just very appropriate for our conversation this afternoon. The office of Jared Polis and Earl Blumenauer of Oregon, they are coming out today at 5 o'clock with their bills. Polis, to again, a 2013 bill to repeal federal prohibition of marijuana, make this a 10th Amendment states' rights controlled issue. And Blumenauer is going to come out with something about protecting the banking operations, so that if you're operating a medical marijuana facility, you can bank at your local establishment and not be, and the bank would open up an account for you, so you could take credit cards and checks and all the normal things without being considered part of an ongoing criminal enterprise with the RICO laws.
Oh, that's very important, of course. It's an important issue, because that, my understanding is that that's one of the threats that some U.S. attorneys, I think specifically in California, have made toward medical marijuana dispensaries. Is, you know, they've warned the banks off, and so these dispensaries that take in a lot of cash don't have any place to put it.
Right, and the other part of that is, of course, the IRS made a rule that they can't take off any of their normal business expenses because it is considered illegal. So they can't have a normal business model where you take your expenses off the top of your profits and then pay taxes on that. They have to pay taxes on their gross income, and they do. But it's obviously a huge burden for those dispensaries, and it's a muddy mess.
It is a muddy mess. So at least that bill would at least address the issue, and you know, if it's adopted, it would attempt to rationalize that. But just the fact that you have the introduction of such a bill, I sense, is a major, major accomplishment, because I don't recall that such legislation having been introduced in the recent past in Congress.
Well, actually, we did have one last session.
Oh, you did?
Okay. In 2011, mm-hmm. 2 years ago, Ron Paul and Barney Frank, a super right and super left kind of guys, got together on this issue and introduced a bipartisan bill that was the first ever since prohibition at the federal level in 1937. But the first bill was 2 years ago to repeal Federal Prohibition Act of 2011. So this is a basically the same thing, 2.0. I've had a copy, advanced copy of the bill, and it is essentially it's the same as last time. It just says apply the 10th Amendment, take marijuana out of Schedule 1, and if you cross, and now there's actually a case if you're a scenario. If you cross from a smoky state like Colorado into a smoke-free state like Kansas, you commit a federal offense as you cross the border there, and the federal government will go after you. The ATF, you know, the alcohol, tobacco, firearms people, will be renamed the alcohol, tobacco, marijuana firearms to help out those states that want to continue to deny Willie Nelson and his friends the rights to toke up.
Something else you said also rings a bell, and that is that you've mentioned prohibition several times and the repeal of prohibition. That also, of course, occurred in the depths of the Great Depression. The prohibition of alcohol was largely repealed. I think it took effect in 1931. And, of course, immediately the tax revenues started flowing into the federal coffers as they had prior to prohibition. I really think that might be, that's just my guess, my horse sense, that might be the primary motivation that's brought in a lot of certainly more conservative and fiscally conservative people in, because almost every state is in some sort of fiscal crisis these days, and the federal government itself, of course, is running huge deficits. So I imagine that properly regulated and taxed, this could be an enormous boon to state and federal treasuries.
Well, it would be, and in fact, let me mention this just this morning on the heels of the announcement from Polis's office, the advance notice, I sent a message to Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform, you know, the famous guy who says no new taxes and all that kind of stuff, and I said, what will be your position on the states that are going to tax marijuana? It'll be a new tax. Will that be a violation of his famous pledge? And I've got an email into his office. He and I meet his folks once a week there at their Wednesday brunch, and it'll be interesting to see his response on that. I can tell you, he's very much a libertarian and on our side on the marijuana issue, believing in less federal government, less government intrusion, more personal liberty. And the question is, how will he finesse the issue of allowing states to tax this brand new product? I'll let you know as soon as I get a response from his office.
And that's our show. What is the world coming to? We just were talking to a cop who is opposed to marijuana prohibition, and his conversations with tax cutter Grover Norquist on the same subject. The landscape is just shifting too quickly beneath my feet. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.